Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
What do you have for us, Bill?
Well, our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape has everything you need when it comes to John Deere. They got tractors, mowers, implements, full parts and service, you name it. Go up and see them. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. Or you can give them a call at 530-226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
And there you have it.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to keep the foolishness to a minimum today because we're talking about climate science with someone who actually knows things about climate science, which is exciting because there is so much misinformation out there about that. It just seems to never end. So the timing is excellent for us to chat with our guest, Dr. Judith Curry. She is president and co-founder of Climate Forecast Applications Network, CFAN. She's a professor emerita at the Georgia Institute of Technology, where she served as chair of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences for 13 years. I'm sure we'll talk about that a little bit more. Her expertise is in climate dynamics, extreme weather, and prediction predictability. Curry is a fellow of the American Meteorological Society, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the American Geophysical Union. Following an influential career in academic research and administration, Curry founded CFAN to translate cutting-edge weather and climate research into forecast products and services. Sorry, we are going to talk about politics too. Forecast products and services that support the management of weather and climate risk for public and private sector decision makers. Curry is a leading global thinker on climate change. She's frequently called upon to give U.S. congressional testimony and serve as an expert witness on matters related to weather and climate. Her influential blog, Climate Etc., addresses leading-edge and controversial topics about climate change and science policy interface. Her new book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk, Rethinking the Climate Change Problem, The Risks We Are Facing and How We Can Respond, is available now. And we've given you links at wethepeopleradio.us. You can find this interview this afternoon. It is actually Sunday, October 1st, when we're airing this the first time, and I'm positive we'll air this again. But just for, you know, perspective, it's October 1st, 2023 at this particular time. And links to her book, links to her her Twitter. Just can't do the X thing. It's still Twitter. To her Twitter connection and her blog, judithcurry.com, is her website. So judithcurry.com. Super simple and easy to find. And I've watched several, Bill and I both did, we watched several YouTube interviews with Dr. Curry. And the more we watched, the more we were like, okay, we know all this stuff is kind of, we know they're making a lot of it up, but we don't have any proof. She's got all the proof. So we're going to let her do the bulk of the talking because, well, she knows all of this. Dr. Curry, we appreciate you spending your Sunday afternoon with us.
Hello, Aaron. Thanks for inviting me.
Sure. We couldn't help but laugh every interview somehow. Always had to highlight the fact that you're a climate
denier,
which of course we get called that all the time, but you're a climate disinformation purveyor or something. What was the other one they call you? I was like, that's a new one. I guess if you're a scientist, you get a better name, huh?
Well, you know, a little bit of backstory on that. This isn't about science or my take on the science of climate change. Things went south for me in 2010 when I started criticizing the climate community for their behavior, and this was following the ClimateGate emails. I don't know if you. Okay, so I started raising issues about saying we need to make all of our data publicly available. We need to be transparent in our methods. We need to be more honest and open about the uncertainties. And we need to be more respectful of people who disagree with us.
And well, that would make you a heretic for sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that did it. And it really got bad when I started criticizing the hockey stick. And then that's when all the denier and serial climate disinformer and all those names started. And it's very little to do with the actual substance of climate science. I certainly have a much broader perspective than what you'll get from the IPCC. But nothing that I'm saying is, you know, outside of the range of what should be considered here. It's really more about the social dynamics of the climate community and their perceived need to present a united front so that they can influence policymaking and so that their research will be well funded.
Well, we hear that all the time that the science is settled, and I'm 62, so I was in sixth grade a long time ago, but I remember in sixth grade something to the effect that science is never settled. I mean,
you were taught well in the sixth grade. Okay, I mean, you know, there's a few obvious facts here, you know, surrounding climate change. Yes, temperatures have been increasing for more than 100 years. Yes, humans emit carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Yes, carbon dioxide has an infrared emission spectra and therefore acts to warm the planet, all other things being equal. However, the most consequential issues about whether CO2-driven warming has dominated over natural climate variability, how the climate of the 21st century will play out, whether climate change is dangerous. These are the most consequential issues, and there's a great deal of disagreement and uncertainty that the important people are trying to sweep under the rug.
Yeah, because in one of them you had said, like, basically there are unknowns about what's unknown. I mean, it's just there's a lot of this that isn't so easy to pin down, and it isn't as simplistic as they would like to paint it.
Oh, for sure. I mean, the climate system is exceedingly complex. And, you know, simplistic notions of more research reduces the uncertainty. Well, it doesn't work that way. It just seems to add more dimensions of things that we had previously neglected that we now need to consider. So the complexity continues, you know, our perception of the complexity of all this is ever growing.
we haven't,
you know, come close to reaching, you know, peak understanding or peak identification of all the factors that might be involved. So, I mean, and we get surprises all the time. The bad surprises get highlighted in the media.
Right.
Okay, but anything good, unexpectedly good, or on the cold side, of course, gets completely ignored. So you get this one.
It just doesn't fit the
view of what's going on.
Yeah, it doesn't.
And we have
doesn't
unprecedented
fit the narrative that they're trying to drill us with.
Oh, yeah, and you know, the simplistic idea that they're trying to frighten us into urgently, you know, reducing our use of fossil fuels. Well, you know, if the climate change is really going to be bad, you know, I don't think that it is, but let's say for a minute that they're right. the worst thing that we could do is cripple our energy system and supply, and so that we have inadequate and irregular energy supplies, so we can't stay warm in the winter. We can't run the desalination plants when we need them, and so forth and so on. So electricity and energy is the foundation for keeping us safe from extreme weather and climate events. So the last thing we should be doing is messing with our electricity supply I'm not saying that we shouldn't advance and try to build a better 21st century infrastructure, but this imperative to kneecap the fossil fuel industry before we have proven replacements is a really dangerous strategy.
Well, and coming up with these arbitrary, I'm sure as a scientist, the word arbitrary probably is kind of like the F word for you guys, but you know, come up with these arbitrary goals. By this magical date, we're going to get rid of this amount of CO2. I mean, that's not really a thing, is it?
We can't do that.
Well,
they've set emissions targets and temperature targets. You know, back in 1992, before we had any understanding of any of this, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change had a treaty which 196 countries signed, including the U.S., to prevent dangerous anthropogenic climate change. And the way we do this is by eliminating emissions from fossil fuels. And this is back in 1992, before we had any evidence that there was warming being caused by humans. And, you know, we had very little understanding. But we already had this policy in place decades before we had any credible understanding of what was going on. So we've had the policy cart way out in front of the scientific horse from the very beginning. And the whole notion of dangerous, which is central to the UN treaty, they never really gave a definition. And it wasn't until 2010 that they decided that the definition of dangerous was 2 degrees of warming relative to pre-industrial times. Okay, and that was a political decision. The UN climate assessment, the IPCC, was not involved in that decision, but it was a political decision that was designed to provide, you know, maximum political pressure to reduce CO2 emissions. I mean, you know, think about, okay, since pre-industrial times, we've already warmed by 1.2 degrees centigrade. I hate to use centigrade. I know people in the U.S. think Fahrenheit, but to get degrees Fahrenheit, just double it. All of the climate treaties and everything is done in terms of centigrade or Celsius. So 2 degrees, we've already warmed 1.2 degrees, and the reference point was really at the end of the Little Ice Age, which was the coldest period of the millennium. Okay, they were, you know, George Washington, think Valley Forge and the terribly cold, crazy winters in Europe. There were famines, crazy cold weather and drought, you know, and big famines, and they were drowning witches because they were blaming them for the bad weather. I mean, thinking that that pre-industrial weather was some kind of a nirvana is basically a big joke. But apart from that, for the past, you know, 150 years where we've warmed 1.2 degrees, I mean, humans have made amazing progress. Technological progress, population has increased incredibly, and there's a far fewer number of people who are in poverty and who are exposed to, you know, severe food shortages. The deaths from extreme weather events and climate events, hurricanes, whatever, you know, have dropped by 97%, you know, in the last 100 years. Agricultural productivity has increased by leaps and bounds. So, you know, we've been doing really well, you know,
yeah,
either because of the warming or in spite of the warming, I couldn't tell you, but we're doing just fine.
Well, you know, we also learned in sixth grade that CO2 makes plants grow.
Exactly.
Still true, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the, and all of, any positive impacts of warming or increasing CO2 are completely ignored. One of them is that there's global greening.
Oh, yeah.
You hear about that. For the past 30 years, satellite observations show that, you know, the globe is greening. So this means plants uptake more CO2, which helps, you know, us manage the CO2 issue. it helps the agricultural productivity also. I mean, other good things about warming, I mean, there's, you know, I find it sort of comical when, like, Montana and Canada are worried about warming.
Yeah, right.
You folks would
North Dakota.
A lot better off. Yeah, North Dakota with some warmer temperatures. I mean, Siberia, northern China, Canada, and the Great Plains states in the U.S. would all do better with warmer temperatures, and this is sort of forgot. In the U.S., people hate cold winters, which is why we see people leaving. Well, one reason we see people leaving New York and Illinois, cold states, and moving to warm states like Florida and Texas and Arizona. So people don't like the cold weather. So, you know, this whole notion that warmer temperatures are, you know, absolutely dangerous, you know, is really the weakest part of their whole argument.
I look at these guys and it's got to be kind of embarrassing. I mean, when we were kids in school, they were telling us we were all going to freeze to death because it was the ice age coming, and then it changed. When we come back, we've got to take a really quick break, but when we come back, I don't want to skip the part about how the IPCC has multiple parts. I think the public basically believes it's all one big thing. And it actually isn't, and that was interesting. I didn't know that either, and I don't assume anybody else does. So let's make sure we work that in as we go. Our guest is Dr. Judith Curry. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
And I wonder if I'm really with you now. Just chasing after some finer day. Anticipation is making me late. It's keeping me
said if you ever need some music for your book. Love to be blinded by actual science. Okay, so Bill's been percolating a question over here.
Yeah, I Dr. Curry, I was just curious. You know, we talk about human-caused CO2. What is, I don't know if you know the numbers, but how much CO2 that we deal with on a daily basis is human-caused versus natural, like from volcanoes and that sort of thing. I know we just here in the last, I think, year or two ago, there was a huge volcano that erupted, I think, somewhere around Tonga that was really underreported.
Yeah, Tonga. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was supposed to, like, have an effect as far as cooling the planet for, like, 5 years. And that was really underreported. So how big of impact is the natural cause CO2?
Okay, well, if you read the IPCC, you know, all of the increase in carbon dioxide is caused by humans. But that is disputed by some scientists. I mean, the land and the oceans have a complex carbon dioxide cycle. So the amount in play from humans is a small fraction of the natural variability. But according to the IPCC, the idea is that the natural part of this is in equilibrium, whereas the human part is the part that's causing the increase. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's lots of different sources of carbon dioxide. But the idea, and the perturbation from Hunga Tonga is interesting. There was some CO2. Usually volcanoes have a cooling effect because they emit sulfate particles into the stratosphere. Well, Hunga Tonga emitted only a small amount of sulfate particles into the stratosphere, but a lot of water vapor into the stratosphere.
Oh, okay.
So Hunga Tonga is actually having a warming effect on the planet in the winter hemisphere. So this is something that's pretty unusual from Hunga Tonga. But the point is there's a lot of natural climate variability going on. And there's actually a blog post on my blog, Climate Etc., judithcurry.com, that's currently discussing a controversial new paper that plays down the human impact on the global carbon dioxide budget. So, I mean, this is still something. The IPCC would not have you think that there's any disagreement, but there clearly is some different ways of looking at this whole thing and a lot of things that we don't know.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, this is just another classic example of the amount of variables we have that are going to affect our climate, which really makes me question a lot of these climate models. I mean, how can they come up with these predictions, you know, in the next 12 years we're all gonna, you know, fry or freeze or whatever it is, when we really don't know a lot of these variables until they happen. So I don't know, how do they create these models with these predictions?
Well, see, Chapter 7 of my new book goes into this in quite some detail. But the point is, these are complex models that include a lot of processes, atmosphere and ocean circulations, things like that. But things like volcanic eruptions or solar variability, that has to be specified.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just making assumptions that, you know, it's going to continue the way it has been, which is not necessarily a good assumption.
Right.
The other thing that these models don't do very well is they don't simulate the large-scale, long-term ocean circulations, which have a big influence on not just surface temperature, but on, you know, actual weather and climate conditions. And the models don't do a good job at that. So basically what the climate models do is show sensitivity to increasing carbon dioxide, you know, how much warming you would expect from increasing carbon dioxide. Now, that's obviously only one part of the climate puzzle. And even this response, the so-called sensitivity of global surface temperature to increasing carbon dioxide, has a factor of 300% uncertainty.
Uh-huh.
And this is acknowledged by the UN climate assessments, the IPCC. So there's, you know, a great deal of uncertainty in all this. And thinking that we can, you know, make specific predictions that will exceed this temperature in 2050, or we can only afford this much more emissions. I mean, this is based on, you know, very inadequate climate models.
And
lots of fear.
And it kind of gets back to what you were going to talk about earlier about the political side of the IPCC and our rush to make these radical responses to the climate when we really don't know what our future effects are going to be, but yet we want to make these.
Well, it's even worse. It's not that we don't want to know. It's that we won't let anyone explore it, because if you do, then you're bad.
Yeah.
And so how are you ever going to figure anything out if everybody, you know, anybody who's trying to get more information you know, gets a bag thrown over their head and thrown into the back of a trunk. I mean, that's not really all that helpful. So for those of us that are IPCC dumb, okay, so it's the International Panel on Climate Change. I think we've all had that thrown in our face quite a bit over the last, you know, decade. But I think most people, because they always talk about how all of the scientists at the IPCC are in a consensus of yada, yada, yada. But by watching your videos, I realize there are multiple parts of that organization. And there is some actual science. Can you kind of sketch the layout of that a little bit?
Okay. The IPCC works for the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. Again, that's the UN organization that does the treaties, the Paris agreements, and so on. Okay, so on the IPCC's first report was published in 1990, and they've recently published their sixth assessment report. So there's three working groups in the IPCC. The first one is the physical basis. The second one is impacts and adaptation. And the third one is mitigation. So the sciencey part is part one. Okay, the sixth assessment report, which working group one, which was published in 2021, it was a pretty good report. It was certainly better than the fifth and the fourth assessment reports and the third assessment report. But you have to dig deep in the bowels to get the really good information. If you just read the summary for policymakers, now each of these reports has a summary for policymakers, and these summaries are written in collaboration with policymakers during a week-long meeting where the IPCC presents findings and then the summary for policymakers want this or that emphasized, this or that changed, and so forth and so on. So the summary for policymakers has a lot of cherry picking and a lot of spin, okay, yeah, relative to what was in the bowels of the report. And so you've got this spun summary for policymakers, and then UN officials start hyping it up, calling code red and existential threat and whatever crazy things, and then the media, you know, take it from there. Okay, and so what the public consumes is a bunch of alarmist spin. Okay, back to the other working groups, working groups two and working groups three. Okay, working group two relates to impacts and adaptation. Now, the fifth assessment report, the working group two report, was quite good. All right. Yeah, there was spin in the summary for policymakers, but I think they did their job really well. Not the case for the sixth assessment report. They viewed the whole exercise as trying to develop a rationale for urgently reducing fossil fuels, and they even stated that in their conclusion. So they didn't do their job right at all.
They didn't do the science and then come up with a conclusion. They came up with a conclusion backed the science in.
Well, a lot of the science, you know, that was established in working group one, they got it wrong in working group two, saying that there was an increase in this or that when working group one didn't find one.
Oh.
So, I mean, there was a lot of inconsistent science, but most of it they were just trying to, it was clear that they were trying to provide a rationale for rapidly reducing fossil fuels rather than doing their job and talking about impacts and adaptation. Okay. So that's working group two. Now, working group three. Working group three in the fifth assessment report, again, wasn't too bad, but again, they did their whole report without apparently having been aware of what working group one was writing.
Wow.
So they went off in a direction that was not really consistent with working group one, so that's sort of a problem. And one of the key conclusions of the fifth assessment working group three was that, you know, most of the problems, you know, are not so much related to climate change, but to poverty and poor governance. Okay.
Whoops. Okay. That's that awkward.
And that was in the summary, the first draft of the summary for policymakers. But when the final version didn't include that, you know, because the policymakers didn't like it, and they had a more conventional gloom and doom message about we need to reduce emissions.
Yeah, we need to get back to the narrative here.
Yeah, right.
So a lot of this depends on, you know, who is assigned to be lead authors on these IPCC reports, and this is a very political issue. Countries nominate people, and then the IPCC nominates further people, and then they pick who they want. So it's people with my kind of perspective don't get invited to serve on the IPCC. I mean, that they have to give a report that the UN framework, the UN climate negotiators want, otherwise they'll be put out of business. I mean, that's pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
There's this chicken and egg situation where you've got really policy-driven science more than science-driven policy.
Yeah, which is a huge violation of the whole concept.
Right. So these assessments, I mean, they are authoritative, but they're very politicized. And given that, there needs to be space for people to challenge, to disagree, but that they try to ignore all that, that they put it open for review. And I know a lot of scientists who painstakingly go through this and send in comments, you know, this is incorrect, this needs to be included, whatever. And invariably, they're always ignored. So you know, the whole idea of this extensive peer review, scientific review of these reports is rather a joke. But that, you know, the Working Group 1 report, you know, at least for the IPCC 6 assessment report, you know, is fairly solid. If you ignore the summary for policymakers, the worst thing that happened with the 6 assessment report is that there's a 4th report. There's a synthesis report where they take all the highlights and put it into more of a summary report, and they really spun that in a political way, in a way that I've never seen before in that synthesis report. So this whole thing is just getting more and more politicized.
Wow.
The IPCC, you know, so it's bad. You know, it's a bad situation, and it's bad because the national funding agencies, you know, in the U.S., this would be, you know, National Science Foundation, NOAA, Department of Energy, whatever. They're funding research that supports IPCC objectives. Okay. Spend a lot of money on developing climate models, and they support regional climate assessments about the dangers of human-caused climate change and whatever. And all those announcements presuppose a certain direction for all of this.
Right.
You know, that climate models rule and that we're looking for dangerous human-caused climate change. So, you know, anything else is completely marginalized and isn't going to get funding from federal funding agencies.
See, and I think that's become kind of clear. I think even people who don't work in that industry have noticed that. I mean, even our local policy stuff, especially in California. I mean, if you want to get money for a project, you've got to somehow get some sort of climate change. Link. I guess you've got to somehow work that into what it is you're doing. Otherwise, you're persona non grata.
For sure. Even in, you know, the National Institute of Health, you know, I have friends, colleagues who work in public health, and they say the secret to getting any money from the National Institute of Health is to put some sort of climate change spin on it. Okay.
Wow.
So the National Institute of Health is throwing all this money at the health impacts of climate change, which are very difficult to discern, you know, and you have to wonder, you know, with all that money going in that direction, that we were ill prepared for the pandemic.
Yeah. I wonder why. Yeah. Well, besides, you know, the corruption, corruption and everything else. So you got to factor that in.
Yeah. So the World Health Organization in 2018 made this statement, something like that. Climate change is the greatest threat to public health, to global public health.
Oh, I remember when they did that. Yeah.
Century. Uh-huh. Well, maybe the pandemic was a whole lot worse.
Yeah, no kidding.
Know, in short years.
Maybe we could handle the weather after all. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
We have to take a really quick break again. Gosh, Judith.
Okay, now speaking of weather.
We're going to have to talk to you about a million times. We have to take a really fast break, but we're going to be right back. Our guest, Dr. Judith Curry, is our hostage for the rest of the program, so don't worry. We've still got tons of stuff that we're going to learn from her. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Now here we have two real pioneers embarking upon a new career, capitalizing on this global warming hype. Yeah, they're the ones that brought you the left-handed hammer and tried to market a recycled pamper. You could say the Gullible brothers have always been the entrepreneurial type. But this next harebrained Gullible venture could be earmarked as the major clincher as to whether or not they'll be living it up in their retirement age. They put all they had into one bankroll, bought a bunch of land down at the South Pole, eagerly awaiting the impending doom of climate change, thereby being in the catbird seat in the new Florida. And I'm all for working hard to keep this planet clean, but man-made global warming just don't make no sense to me. But if you insist on buying into this media false alarm, I know a couple of guys who wheel and deal in frozen farms.
Had to throw a little Ray Stevens Global Warming song in there. I just want to say Dr. Curry did not choose the music. That's our fault. So if you're going to blame somebody, you can go ahead and blame us.
just before the break, we kind of interrupted our thought on the weather.
Yes.
And I guess
the alarm about global warming in the public's mind is related to bad weather, okay, extreme weather. The most recent event is the crazy flooding in New York City, you know, that happened, you know, like 2 days ago, you know, just crazy flooding. Oh, my God, insane global warming. Well, Central Park in New York City has rainfall records back to 1856. And if you look at those rainfall records, last week's event ranks number 9th in terms of worst event, you know, over the last 160 years or so. So, you know, back in the 1880s and stuff like that, there were really bad events. Back in 1910, there were really bad events, and these had nothing to do with carbon dioxide. So the point is, if you look back to the first half of the 20th century or back to the 18th century where there's some weather data, invariably you find worse weather events that you cannot in any way blame them on CO2 emissions. So if you take the extreme weather, bad weather, out of the equation, what you're left with is the slow creep of warming and the impact on sea level rise and slow melting of glaciers. I mean, that's what we're talking about. And those are very slow processes. In spite of the alarming scenarios that some people have tried to paint, by using extremely implausible emission scenario and extreme amounts of warming and completely uncertain and poorly known processes that might cause the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet or something that would be in an impact in the 22nd or 23rd centuries. Okay,
yeah.
So this
yeah.
is what we're talking about in terms of, you know, possible adverse impacts from global warming. We're talking about the slow creep of sea level rise, pretty much, you know, which we can adapt to. So it's very hard. But like I said before, this whole issue, whether warming is dangerous, is the weakest part of their argument. And by relying on extreme weather events, they're in very shaky territory, because extreme weather events are dominated by the large-scale, multi-decadal ocean oscillation patterns and the associated atmospheric circulation. We've been in a bad spell since 2017, the warm phase of the Atlantic multi-decadal oscillation, the cool phase of the Pacific decadal oscillation, those things that combine, you know, to give bad weather, particularly in North America and Europe. Now, that's going to flip at some point, you know, time scale of a decade probably, and then we're going to see a period of relatively benign weather. And we'll cycle back again and see periods of bad weather. I mean, this is just how weather works. And blaming all of this on human-caused warming, fossil-fueled warming, I mean, it's just fallacious.
No, there was a photograph, and I don't know, I don't remember the exact year, but I believe it was in the 1850s, 1860s. But there was a picture of the East River and some walls, some brick walls that were showing the level of the river. And that was like 100 years ago. And it's.
Okay. Is this in California?
No, I think it was in New York.
Okay.
And the actual ocean level hadn't risen significantly at all in this last 100
yeah,
years.
Yeah, I do remember that. I don't remember where that.
But
yeah,
they you know
well,
they,
look at this. Yeah, it's been a slow creep. You
yeah.
know, it's been less than a foot. You know, more like 8 inches, something like that. That's pretty small. You know, and you're trying to, you know, with ocean waves and tides, I mean, that kind of increases in the noise that we've seen so far. Now, when you mentioned like 1860 or something, I immediately keyed on the incredible atmospheric river events that occurred during winter of 1861 to 1862, when most of Central California was under 10 feet of water. That lasted for a couple of months. I mean, you know,
wow.
That's much, you know, that's like a really, really bad one. You know, nothing like what we even saw, you know, way worse than anything we saw last year or in recent
yeah,
memory.
But again, it was an event. Yeah, it was a singular event that you can't pin the a cycle on, really.
No, it's just saying that really bad weather has happened in the past, even worse weather has happened in the past that clearly had nothing to do with CO2 emissions.
Yeah. I always, the extreme weather events, you know, when they say, oh, we've never had this much, you know, snow, we've never had this much whatever. Well, when I was a kid, I lived in Connecticut, and I remember it must have been really early 1970s, and they had massive flooding. One, it was fall, wasn't winter yet, but it was fall. And I remember we were kids. It was fun. It's big time fun, actually. We were diving off of cars that were parked in the street. The water was up over the cars, and we had to take the canoes from our neighbor who was the Boy Scout regional guy. He had a bunch of canoes in his garage. So we got to take the canoes and canoe all the businessmen from the bus stops down to their houses. It was a fine money making opportunity for a child. I've never forgotten it. But you know, they say we've never had these things. Well, I guarantee you, nobody had an SUV when I was a kid. So all this stuff that supposedly caused all this, I haven't seen any of that happen since then. We shoveled a lot more snow back then, too. They have not had anywhere near the snow we had way back then.
No, for sure. Flooding's a big issue. Now, going back to the New York flood, I was just reading an article this morning where some city official was, you know, he was asked in an interview, well, you need to fix the sewers, you know, so the sewers can handle all this.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. So, you know, to fix these storm sewers, we would have to dig up all the streets in the city of New York, and this would cost a couple $1 billion. Well, duh. And you think it's better to spend $1 trillion getting rid of fossil fuel plants and putting in, you know,
that are ultimately going to have no impact.
Exactly. So spend your $1 billion and fix the storm sewers. And it's not just, it doesn't have to, making sure they're clean. I mean, we have plenty of warning for this storm that it was going to be a major event. I remember I told my clients back on, I think last Tuesday, you know, expect, you know, up to six to eight inches. and that's pretty much how it played out. So there was plenty of warning. So can you please get out there and make sure all the sewers are clean, that they're not blocked by leaves or whatever debris? Okay, give people some warning to get their cars or stuff away so they're not interfering with the sewers. I mean, these are simple actions.
Yep.
That would improve the situation. Then you can do this before you even start thinking about digging up all the streets of New York City. But, you know, just blaming this stuff on climate change gives the politicians an out, you know.
Yeah, it's a reason to just lay there and do nothing, you know. You're just going to lie down because, well, there's nothing we can do anyway. It's climate change. And I wonder how much of that is actually orchestrated to prove, you know, as ways to show that, well, see,
well,
this is what we told you.
Well, I think it's at the city level, I think it's not orchestrated.
No, that's
that
just
way.
Kind of bad planning.
It's a really easy out, you know, cover your ass kind of thing.
Yeah.
Blame it on climate.
Yeah. Well, and out here, you know, every time we have a lightning strike, it's climate change. That's what cuts the trees on fire. You know, it doesn't matter that our forests are massively overstocked and, you know, we have all these forest management problems. It's all climate change. So if we all stop driving, but we didn't manage the forest, I guess lightning doesn't light trees on fire then. I mean, I guess by inference, right?
Yeah, it's just a very easy out for lazy politicians.
Yeah. I'm curious I guess this IPCC thing just still sticks in my craw because we're constantly bludgeoned by these guys and they are the experts driving the bus, you know? We've only got like a couple of minutes, but that's okay. We have you as our hostage, as I previously announced. We'll be able to go into the next hour, but in a perfect world, right, if the thing was run correctly, the working group one of the IPCC does the scientific research. Like they're the scientists. Is that kind of the idea?
Right. Yeah.
So they've got like, this is what we discovered. Here it all is. And then working group two, do they take that data and then run it through what, another filter of some sort?
Well, no, the working groups operate concurrently.
Oh, they do?
So by
time,
yeah, they operate concurrently.
Just with, like, different missions or something? So you got the scientist guys in one. Who's running two?
Yeah. Well, you've got other people who specialize on impact. You've got economists and whatever.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then mitigation. So you don't have full consistency across the reports. You know, they should stagger it so that the working group one report is completed a year or two before working group two and working group three is completed.
Oh my gosh, no wonder it doesn't make any sense. That even makes less sense. And then the third group is kind of the politics spin guys, where we're going to take away everybody's cars and fine everybody for climate change and yada yada yada.
It tells you how to meet the net zero target, you know, without doing a full a proper cost benefit analysis of whether this makes any sense at all.
Wow, bizarre. All right, we've got to break for the news. We'll see what they have to tell us, and we'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Judith Curry. You're listening to We the People Radio.